Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. I couldn't be more excited to talk with our first guest, and I think you will find it a very, very illuminating and important conversation as well. His name is Congressman Barry Loudermilk. It's been a privilege to know him, not well, but for a long time. He has been representing the people of the 11th District of Georgia in the United States House of Representatives. And these days, he is chairing a very important subcommittee of the House Administration Committee. It's oversight subcommittee, and among the things he is overseeing is what actually happened on January 6th, 2021. And we're very, very interested in what he has found to date, where the evidence is leading, and what we've been told so far about this that, well, may simply not be true. Congressman, it's good to have you with us once again. It's been too long, but we hope this will be the first of many visits in the future. Welcome back,
Frank,
sir.
I appreciate all the work that you do. And yeah, it has been too long, so we be glad to do this more often.
We'll make up for lost time. I wanted to start by just asking you a question that arises from a very provocative interview that Tucker Carlson had with one of your colleagues, Clay Higgins, from Louisiana the other day. I know you're familiar with its contents, but just for our audience's sake, let me just say, among other things, that Congressman Higgins, who has a background, as you know, in law enforcement, quite impressive, in fact, and having done a lot of forensic work of his own on all of this, he says this looks like, well, my word's not his, I guess, a set-up job, a direct action, perhaps, in the terms of the trade, specifically about the role the FBI played in all of it. And I wonder if you have any comments you could make at this point about that. Those sort of findings by him.
Yeah, well, Clay, you're right. Clay Higgins does have extensive background in law enforcement. He's a good friend of mine. In fact, we're going to be meeting about some of the forensics that he has been doing and the claims he's made. Now, one thing we're doing in this committee is running a true investigation, unlike what the Select Committee did, which appears to have been just finding evidence to support a preconceived narrative. We're going where the evidence leads. In fact, my direction to our team is if you hear of something, a theory, or someone brings a perceived fact to us, our job is not to prove that to be true. It's really to prove it untrue. Because if you just want to prove a theory true, you will every time because you'll discredit any evidence that's contrary. And that's exactly what the Select Committee did. Right. What we want to do is take
Is it fair to say, sir, that they only really looked for evidence that supported their theory of the case as well?
Exactly. Well, and there was evidence that was presented to them contrary to their preconceived outcome, and that was either discredited or, as we'll probably talk about here in a little bit, it was deleted. So, but we take a look at the evidence. We try to prove a theory false. When you can't, then you know you've got to the truth. So everything is evidence driven for us. And so we do have evidence that we have proved to be true of plainclothes law enforcement officers embedded in the crowds. Now, as you know, as national security specialist that you are, that is not unusual. You kind of expect that where big crowds are gathered at the nation's capital, you put assets within the crowd to protect the protesters, for one thing, and to protect their rights, but also looking for potential international terrorists, et cetera. The fact that they were there was not concerning. What's concerning to us was the actions by a select number of those in the crowd. We have a Metropolitan Police officer who was undercover encouraging people to go into the Capitol. Another thing that's concerning to us is the timeline. No one from the executive branch is allowed to be on U.S. Capitol property without explicitly being asked to come in by the Capitol Police or Capitol Police Board. So if any of these were federal agents or metropolitan agents that were on the Capitol property before Chief Sund enacted the mutual aid agreement, we have another problem. So
Could I just ask you to specifically talk to this point? Plain clothes is one thing, dressed up as Trump supporters,
right,
and inside the Capitol before the rally at the mall broke up is something that Congressman Higgins has suggested took place. And that would, it seems, be something that could only have happened with the knowledge and permission of people running the Capitol Police.
Yeah, now someone, I don't believe that was Chief Sund, because we've met with him several times. And first of all, I don't have evidence, and I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'm just saying I haven't seen the evidence of what Representative Higgins is presenting. That's one of the reasons we want to meet. And I'm not discrediting his claim at all. But if when we meet with him, I also want to cross-reference that with the 44,000 hours of video that we have, you know. And so we've actually taken
that. And you have access to all of that video?
Absolutely. Yeah, unfettered. Good. And in fact, Frank, you have access to that. All Americans have access to that. We have opened out, as you know, we are putting those videos out for public consumption. It takes a while to process them and convert them into an internet friendly format. So that's why it's rolling out.
So it's
but
still
you can schedule
to
come in and look at them. We've opened it up to all Americans, and we know it's not feasible for everybody to come here, but if you want to come in and take a look at anything, you can schedule to do it. But yes, we have.
And why that's so important, I think, is as I believe Higgins talked about in the Tucker interview, crowdsourcing this body of incredible, you know, quantities of video is probably the only way to get at it, don't you think?
There are, and we're having more people give us, you know, iPhone or, you know, smartphone video, which, again, our 44,000 hours of video are surveillance. There's no audio. So when you saw the select committee presenting these videos and you hear the crowd screaming and glass breaking, that was all Hollywood production. They dubbed those sound effects in there. But we do have body cam footage too from Metropolitan Police and others that we can cross-reference. So what I want to do with Clay is let's compare our notes and then we can look and you know, hopefully try to figure out get a bigger picture of what is going on.
Yeah. Well, and as you say, evidence driven.
That's right.
I commend you for taking that approach. And it's also the case, I think it's important to say, you're doing this in accordance with, I guess, what you might call regular order. There
right.
are Democrats participating in this oversight. They are given a chance to ask questions of witnesses, you know, challenge witnesses and so on. Is that right?
That's right. And that was played out in some of the hearings we've had already, which amazingly, there was some bipartisan agreement on, let's say, the irregularities of what happened and the report of the January 6th Select Committee, especially when former Chief Sund, who was the chief of police on January 6th, who was mysteriously fired by Pelosi the next day before we could do any after action. He's been a source of a lot of information. And during his hearing, he exposed a lot of political involvement in security decisions that raised the eyebrows of Democrats as well. Now, of course, they've been more defensive of the January 6th Select Committee. They haven't directly participated in a lot of what we're doing. They're open to come over and look at videos and look at documents. I don't think that they've chosen to do that. But yes, it is. We're trying to push this as a bipartisan effort.
We have to take a break in just a moment, sir. But when we come back, I want to drill down on the January 6th committee a little bit more. But just on this key point, to the extent that there was political involvement in decisions, for example, as I understand it, to set the level of security, not at a heightened level, given what was going
right.
on, and among other things, Donald Trump's warnings. But maybe we need the National Guard, not even to have it as a business at usual level, but actually to have it below that level. And then these instances in which people were actually invited in. All of this is something I'd like to talk to you about a little bit more on the other side of this short break. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more with Congressman Barry Lauterbach right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. South Africa will open a new front today in the war on the Jews by charging their only state, Israel, with genocide in Gaza at the International Court of Justice. And on Saturday, a large demonstration in Washington, D.C., sponsored by the Muslim Brotherhood and its Marxist allies, will amplify this groundless and slanderous charge. Unfortunately, these events are but the latest examples of the mainstreaming of genocidal anti-Semitism. They are made more outrageous by the fact that their principal beneficiary, the terrorist group Hamas, openly declares its intent to destroy the Jewish state. And its supporters here profess the same with their calls to eliminate Israel from the river to the sea. Make no mistake, those determined to exterminate Jews wish the same for Judeo-Christian civilization as well. So Israel is fighting for us, and we must stand with her. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We are continuing this really important conversation with the chairman of the House Administration Committee's Oversight Subcommittee, responsible for doing a serious, rigorous, by-the-books investigation of what actually went down on January 6th. His name is Congressman Barry Loudermilk. He represents with distinction, I might say, the people of the 11th District of Georgia. Congressman, you were talking before the break a little bit about what the erstwhile captain of the chief of the Capitol Hill Police said about political involvement in decisions involving security. And in closing, I said, my sneaking suspicion is Nancy Pelosi was among those who was exercising that kind of political involvement. Any evidence to that effect? So far,
well, we are tracking down some evidence. Let me just say this: that from Pelosi's office, there was heavy engagement with certain people involved in the Capitol Hill security, more specifically in the Sergeant at Arms office, than the Chief of Police or other. Let me just say, other leadership within the Capitol Police than the Chief himself. Give you an example: the word optics comes up quite often in. For instance, the civil defense units of the Capitol Police, based on some intelligence that was received, not all of it, and that's another issue to talk about, is the suppression of intelligence that there was going to be violence, which impacted the level of security. But the chief did order civil defense units or civil disturbance units to be ready. That's the riot police, right? The specially trained folks to be out there because they knew the massive amount of crowds that would be there. However, someone in leadership on the political side did not like the optics of having these police officers in riot gear, so ordered that the riot gear be kept in their buses. And then the buses were moved a good distance away from where they actually were. We've also received some information about how people in the Democrat leadership didn't like the idea of Capitol Police carrying those long black guns. And so the image of a Capitol Police officer actually armed with an AR was somehow a bad thing. So we're seeing that.
They generally are armed with those every day.
They are.
All over the Capitol.
Look, when people come to Washington, D.C., especially go to the White House, you talk to the visitors. We give a lot of tours there. We'll schedule stuff. Everybody wants to see a Secret Service sniper on top of the White House, right? They're looking for that because they know that their government is securing itself. It doesn't scare people to see a Capitol Police officer. They feel comforted. And so, yeah, but even
especially law-abiding, patriotic Americans exactly. who are there to peacefully express their concerns about the election. For
exactly.
Example. Yeah.
But even the optics came up in with the Department of Defense as Chief Sund, seven attempts to get the National Guard to actually
wow.
come to the
seven
Capitol.
Attempts.
Seven. Starting on the 5th, he never got approval to make the request from the decision makers, the Capitol Police Board or the Speaker's office. Let's just say that until shots were fired in the Capitol, and he's on the phone with Pentagon officials, with DHS officials, with others, with shots fired in the Capitol, and still officials at the Pentagon were worried about the perception, the optics of having the National Guard there. So, yes, the politics of it has played heavily in
this is decisions. So troubling, but it's going to perfectly segue into the after action assessment as well. But just one quick clarification. You mentioned shots being fired. Would that be the shot that killed Ashley Babbitt?
It would be that. In fact, that's the only shot that was of lethal weapon that was fired
by a police officer inside the House chamber. Yeah. So let's talk about the January 6th committee, because what you've described in terms of your work and the approach that you're taking is obviously in contrast to it. But Congressman, when you revealed that the body of evidence that had been compiled by that select committee, the videotaped depositions and I guess other transcripts and so on, was not available to you when you went asking for it, to, you know, at a critical stage of your investigation, my head exploded, sir. What is up with that? And how on earth has that been allowed?
Well, that's one thing we're still working on, because there was, as you said, a body of evidence that we were not given the documentation or the videos. The Select Committee was, by House rules, to preserve everything that they used or they obtained during their investigation. But they failed to do that, and they have acknowledged that they just chose not to do some. And the point you were making there was the videos of the individual depositions, which is standard operating procedure here, and they are archived. And the reason it's important, because the chairman of the committee, Benny Thompson, when I questioned him about this, he said, oh, well, you have the written transcripts. That's all you need. Well, not necessarily, because there's body language, there's voice inflection. For instance, if someone answered a question and said, I shot the clerk, well, that's a whole lot different than saying, I shot the clerk? Okay, there's a lot of difference there, right? And especially when it came to Cassidy Hutchins, because Cassidy Hutchinson's first three depositions were totally different than her public statement and her other depositions. And we found a document where she substantively changed her first depositions to match her public statement, fired her attorney, and we're trying to figure out, why was there such a substantive change? We want to see the videotapes. Was she confident in the way she answered the questions the first time versus the second time?
This, so of course, was a gal who was at the time an official in the White House and who came forward with rather damning testimony, at least at some point. But when you say that you had the transcripts, or I'd understood that these transcripts were heavily redacted, if not entirely so.
Some were and some weren't. When we first went into this, nothing was indexed or categorized or anything, cataloged, I should say. It was boxes full of 2.5 or 2 million printed pages and a couple terabytes of digital data. So it took us months to actually figure out what we had. Then we started coming across references to certain other documents that we couldn't find. We came across a letter to where the chairman of the Select Committee, Benny Thompson, sent a suite of documents to the White House and to Homeland Security for them to keep. First of all, that's in violation of House rules. These are House documents. They are not to be held by the executive branch. So I started asking for those. We finally got the White House.
Was there any explanation of why this was done in violation of House rules?
What we were told is that it pertained to national security information that the White House had to preserve, which was security protocols and the way that Secret Service and other things were handled in the White House, which is totally bogus, because you can go out on Prime Video and watch an entire documentary on how the Trump White House Secret Service operate. I mean, it's all there. What we found
but
out,
but more to
though,
the point, that would have been a tiny fraction of the body of work that on that pretext they were sending everything to the administration.
So the White House sent us four of the depositions, heavily redacted. But what we've derived from the unredacted part, and let me reemphasize, we will get these documents. We are about to take another, if I have to, I'll subpoena, which may be coming soon. But we're going to get the documents unredacted. What we can derive from just the parts we can read are these testimonies of these individuals who were with President Trump on January 6th does not line up with the narrative that they presented with
I'm
their
shocked.
Final report.
Shocked.
So what we're seeing is you've got people changing their testimonies from what they originally say, and then certain documents that don't line up with the final narrative, well, those are missing.
I've got 30 seconds to just ask you the money quote. What are the chances that any of this might bear on the criminal prosecution of Donald Trump, let alone those who are currently incarcerated as political prisoners, sir?
Well, Frank, I think it would weigh heavily on Trump's prosecution for this reason. A lot of the prosecution is based on the January 6th Select Committee's report as an official document of Congress. As we see that there is a lot of missing facts, there are a lot of things that they have purposefully, in my opinion, misreported, lies within that document. And so that's why this is important.
Maybe there's no insurrection there after all. Congressman Loudermilk, we're going to have you back as you've learned more. And thank you for your time today. This is extraordinarily important work, and I'm so proud that you're doing it so well. God bless you. We'll be right back, folks. Stay tuned for more.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and I'm very pleased to announce a new feature of this program. We are going to be highlighting some of the partnerships that we at the Center for Security Policy have been engaged with and are very committed to promoting as well as facilitating. And one of the most important of those is an organization I'm proud to be, in addition to my work at the center as its executive chairman, the president and CEO of Save the Persecuted Christians, an organization that we stood up a few years back, building upon a kind of pickup team of what we call the Save Persecuted Christians Coalition. And the executive director of this not-for-profit organization is my friend and colleague, Dee Dee Laugesen. Many of you are familiar with her through her Vanna White routine with our Committee on the Present Danger China webinars, but she's an indispensable force for good, deeply committed Christian and devoted especially to the cause of saving those who are persecuted, both abroad and increasingly here in the United States. Dee Dee, it's great to have you with us, and thank you for stepping up to be a co-host for these segments with me. I so appreciate it.
Thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure to be here and to participate with you in securing America for the future. Thanks.
Well, thank you. That was the larger mission, that's for sure. So Dee Dee, one of the things that we have confronted in our efforts to help persecuted Christians has been the absence all too often, and sometimes the downright malfeasance of the United States government in addressing matters that by law it has a responsibility to address, most especially in terms of simply reporting on what's happening to those denied religious freedom, Christians and others, of course, around the world, but also to interject where it can to help those who are suffering such persecution. Talk about this new State Department annual report and the response to it from the community we work with of international religious freedom activists.
Thanks, Frank. In 1998, the International Religious Freedom Act was passed, and that mandated that the U.S. State Department would track instances of egregious religious violence against people of faith around the world and sanction them and hold them accountable for these crimes against humanity. Since then, it took a long time to get everything in place. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom was established with that law. So was the State Department International Religious Freedom Office and the Office of the International Religious Freedom Ambassador. Secretary Blinken is mandated by law to give Congress a report every year on the state of religious freedom violations in every country in the world. And they have to do this by May. Just last week, they released their designations for countries of particular concern, those countries that are on the special watch list, and also entities of particular concern. Frank, on a regular basis, Secretary Blinken has disregarded the advice coming from the Independent Bipartisan Commission of USERF. They continually disregard their reports, and they are also tracking and monitoring this violence all around the world, which is now subjecting some 360 million Christians to heavy persecution in a record number of countries. So what happened is that Secretary Blinken named 12 countries onto the countries of particular concern, but left off the most egregious violators, and those being Nigeria, India, and Vietnam. Vietnam was put on the special watch list, but USERF insisted that they be put on the countries of particular concern because of the cases that exist there. Frank,
okay, so
it's ridiculous.
Let me just try to unpack some of this. USERF, that you've referred to several times, is the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, and it's a kind of independent watchdog, really, on what's happening, sort of a second opinion. And the response on the part of those folks to, and by the way, there's some people that I consider to be dubious customers on that commission, but nonetheless, they have taken to task the State Department for its failures, notably in Nigeria and several other countries. And I want to talk with you a little bit more about Nigeria, but a word about what it says about the serious defects of the State Department inventory when USERF is coming forward so, rather forcefully for them especially, in decrying some of its shortcomings.
You know, the USERF is continually trying to work together to get the State Department to take action. As I said, Blinken is just doggedly rejecting their recommendations. And
by taking action, you mean basically just citing that they are of particular concern. What is so heavy a lift about that, for heaven's sake?
Exactly. Well, by designating them such, the State Department is then able to place sanctions on them and withdraw aid from the country. But
doesn't necessarily mean they'll do that. It just gives them
a basis
for doing so. And I'm going
to tell you that. Four of these countries immediately received waivers from sanctions. So they designated them and then said, we're not going to, you know, hold you accountable. Nonetheless, we're going to continue working with you on this and hoping to draw you forward. Nigeria was designated as a country of particular concern, which we worked very hard to achieve that at the end of the Trump administration under Secretary Mike Pompeo. When Blinken came in the very next year, one of his first acts was to take Nigeria off that list of countries of particular concern, even though nothing had changed within the state, within the country, and it is getting much worse.
If anything's changed, it has continued to become.
Yeah, we just saw a Christmas massacre in the Plateau State of Nigeria.
Yeah, and Didi, you were there in country in the course of last year. You made a fact-finding mission for our Save the Persecuted Christians team, and I know came away powerfully affected by what you saw there. So when you see, well, set aside Yusuf, when you see, when the community of religious freedom champions, some of them, you know, our friends in Nigeria, but many elsewhere, see this kind of, well, what else to call it, but whitewashing of the Nigerian government and the conduct it's engaged in, sometimes just ignoring the brutal massacres like on Christmas, and in other cases actually contributing to them. No, what give us your actual independent view of all this as well.
Right, Frank, I was there this time last year, just before the presidential elections in Nigeria. Violence continues in the Middle Belt without being addressed after the election of Bola Tinubu. When I was there, I went to the places where our U.S. diplomats refuse to go. They will not go out into the territories and visit with the victims and hear from them themselves. They refuse to do that. They just hear the propaganda. It is unsafe. We traveled with soldiers carrying AK-47s. It is definitely unsafe. It was very, you know, unsettling to be traveling through Nigeria from Benue State up into Plateau State, through many of the areas that since May of this last year have just been pummeled again and again. We're talking thousands of Fulani militants coming into small villages with AK-47s, shooting and hacking to death everybody they find, and burning them to death in their homes. Pastors, mothers in front of their children in front of their parents. It is what Israel experienced on October 7th is happening in Nigeria every single day. And the U.S. State Department, while feigning shock and awe at October 7th's events, just pushes it all under the carpet in Nigeria. And that has to do with the fact that China is gaining ground in Nigeria. China, their Navy has visited and they've built a port there through the Belt and Road Initiative, the Lakey deep water port out of Nigeria. So, you know, there are some pressures
and
on
Chinese
Lincoln.
Naval vessels have been using that port. Is that what you're saying? Well, surprise,
yes.
Surprise, because we know that that's one of the things that the Chinese are putting this Belt and Road infrastructure into support is the power projection of their forces. So, Didi, we have to wrap it up. But for this purpose today, what can people do who are concerned about your report, concerned about the State Department's malfeasance, I would call it?
Yeah, well, Representative Chris Smith has put forth a resolution demanding that Nigeria be put back onto the countries of particular concern, that a special envoy be appointed to Nigeria, which is we have advocated for. So please do call your members of Congress and tell them to support Representative Smith's resolution on Nigeria. And we will be in D.C. at the end of this month for the International Religious Freedom Summit and are bringing Nigerians with us.
Good. Well, one of the things that I think has been very powerful about the Save the Persecuted Christians effort is we are trying actually to hold the people engaged in the persecution accountable. And if you'd like to learn more about that, folks, go to savethepersecutedchristians.org. We'd appreciate your support. It's vitally needed, especially at a time such as this. Didi, we have to leave it at that. Thanks for joining us. Come back soon. We'll talk to you next week, in fact, right after this. Stay tuned for more. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. South Africa will open a new front today in the war on the Jews by charging their only state, Israel, with genocide in Gaza at the International Court of Justice. And on Saturday, a large demonstration in Washington, D.C., sponsored by the Muslim Brotherhood and its Marxist allies, will amplify this groundless and slanderous charge. Unfortunately, these events are but the latest examples of the mainstreaming of genocidal anti-Semitism. They are made more outrageous by the fact that their principal beneficiary, the terrorist group Hamas, openly declares its intent to destroy the Jewish state. And its supporters here profess the same with their calls to eliminate Israel from the river to the sea. Make no mistake, those determined to exterminate Jews wish the same for Judeo-Christian civilization as well. So Israel is fighting for us, and we must stand with her. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. I'm very pleased to welcome, I believe for the first time, Brandon Showalter, a man I've admired from afar for quite some time, but we're really delighted to have him with us to talk about a topic that is, well, taboo in a lot of circuits, but very much at the forefront of American, you know, societal change. And he's covering it very importantly at the Christian Post, where he's a reporter as well as a podcaster, of something called Generation Indoctrination, which is now in its third season. And it's focused, among other things, on the very, very problematic phenomenon that has come to be called the gender identity movement. We're going to ask Brandon to talk a little bit about what is the nature of that movement and the ideology that it applies, and its wellspring as well. Brandon, thank you for taking the time to join us here at Securing America to do that. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be with you.
So give us a read. I mean, there are lots of identities, and we're obviously under siege by identity politics, which I really regard as a Marxist enterprise at its core, designed to divide and conquer nations like ours. What are your thoughts on both the best way to characterize what's afoot here and what we need to do about it?
There are many things I could say about what I think gender identity, so-called gender identity, is, that whole movement. Philosophically speaking, I find it to be kind of a neo-Gnostic cult, if you will, because it promotes the dissociation of the physical body into this amorphous gender identity, and that is a category of personhood that has been inserted into laws and public policies all over the world, but especially here in this country. The idea being that self-determined gender identity, which may or may not be in keeping with one's biological sex, is a person's truest, most authentic self, to borrow some of the gender ideologues' lingo. This is a revolution that has been gestating within our institutions for some time now, decades. The queer theorists in academia have been writing about all these ideas, especially within humanities departments. But it's straight up pseudoscience. But what has happened, especially in this last decade, it has become popularized in the popular culture. And we've seen an explosion of these kinds of identity constructs and categories being marketed to our young people, many of whom are already struggling with mental illnesses, many on the autism spectrum, as though this is their core identity. And in a culture where there has been such profound family breakdown and other factors, this has just kind of been a petri dish of really horrible things. And so it's a neo-Gnostic cult, and it's, you know, a nonsensical ideology, but what it really is, and I would emphasize this the most, is that it is producing, the gender identity movement is producing one of the worst medical scandals that the world has ever seen, because it's telling people to pursue dissociating and medicalizing their bodies and cutting body parts off in pursuit of something that is physically impossible, that of becoming the opposite sex.
Right. I want to come back to the medical piece of this because the money involved, among other things, is shocking, to say the least. But before we leave just the general characterization of what is going on here, I did want to ask you about the extent to which, again, not to harp on this, but some of what seems to be a predictable byproduct of all of this is, you know, devastation to families as well as, you know, these individuals, many of whom are, as you say, struggling with mental health or other problems. And that is, of course, very much a Marxist agenda item. And also, it's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Brendan, that TikTok, which is, of course, an instrument of the Chinese Communist Party, mm-hmm. has been a powerful inculcator among these vulnerable young populations of this idea that you may have been assigned at birth mistakenly something, and there's a wonderful way to fix all of that if only you take this course.
That's right. I very much believe that the role of TikTok and social media more broadly can't be overstated in terms of how it is influencing people to dissociate from their bodies.
Did you say cannot be?
It can't be overstated. It's really important that people understand. So parents who are listening to this, get your kids off TikTok, get your kids off tech, because it's poison. And I very much think that that's something that we really need to be aware of. And the research that has been done over the years, I believe, is convincingly shows that's where so much of a lot of this is being furthered. Yeah. Young girls and teenage girls who have spent inordinate amounts of time on those social media platforms become convinced in friend groups that this is truly who they are, and then they need to go down this path of medicalization. You're right about the money as well, because if you go on these experimental drugs and you continue on with it, you're going to be a patient for life. The surgeries cost a whole lot, and they require a lot of follow-up care. So big pharma...
A lifetime of care, really.
A lifetime, yeah. Correct.
And just the other point first, you know, one of the things that's so striking to me is, of course, the Chinese Communist Party does not allow its version of TikTok to have any of this nonsense on it, right? So again, it plays into my theory of the case that this is a weapon. But the medical community and the degree to which it is profiting massively from this. In fact, it's a whole profit center, I think, for some of these hospitals that, you know, tout themselves as go-to places. Right. Give us a sense, if you can, Brendan, of how big an industry this has become now.
It's definitely a growth industry. I've seen value projection figures from places like Global Market Insights and Acumen Research that they are planning on this being a very much a growth industry. The best sort of snapshot that I can probably give is this happened very recently. Might have been about a year ago when Matt Walsh and his crew down at the Daily Wire went into Vanderbilt Hospital, and they actually had a doctor on tape talking about these, you know, very gruesome, what they call bottom surgeries, which is a euphemism for maiming the genitals to make them look like the other sex. And one of the doctors that was on tape say that this is a great moneymaker for our hospital. And so it was just
good for business, in other words.
Good for business. But
Brandon, hold the thought, because we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want you to complete that thought, because it's cynical and frankly, I think a violation of the Hippocratic Oath, among other things. But we'll talk more about whence this all came right after this. We're back. Brendan Showalter is in the house virtually. We're very pleased to have him from the Christian Post, where he is, among other things, a reporter and podcaster. Among his work is this important, now in its third series, a podcast series entitled Generation Indoctrination. And we've been just discussing how many in the young people of America these days are being indoctrinated with this idea that they really should be something else than what they are biologically. Brandon, I'm told there are now 52 different genders that you could be. I mean, I can't imagine how you could get to those numbers, but the point is you're not what God created, which was male and female, right? And one of the things I wanted you to finish your thought from the last block, but also talk with us a little bit about how has this thing suddenly become so prominent in our society, when you think about the numbers of people with true gender dysphoria being tiny at its core. No.
Well, the only thought I was going to complete was about the money that we'd spoken up in the last segment. And yes, the drugs and the surgeries are, you're creating a problem and then making money off of it, because there are a very small number of people who are dealing with some sort of very severe psychological distress, body dysmorphia over their biological sex. And so I wouldn't want to make fun of those people, certainly. But when you have this sort of mass scale and this cultural push, you start to really want to look under the hood and look behind the curtain and see what's going on there. And so that can't be overstated. I'd very much recommend to all of your listeners that you check out the go-to resource on this. I've reported on a little bit, but Jennifer Billick of the 11th Hour blog has traced the money and its ties to the medical industrial complex and how many wealthy people in that industry are profiting handsomely and are sort of greasing the skids for future profits with this with the gender industry, as she calls it. So that's where I would point
people there. But I would argue greasing the skids for, you know, societal mayhem,
right.
As this you know, metastasizes further. And I have a theory of the case, and I don't know that anybody shares it, but it's mine, that the way this was transformed, if I can use that expression, from, you know, a marginal phenomenon in society and a medical condition, mm-hmm. call it gender dysphoria, into something that has potentially hundreds of thousands, I would guess, if not millions of young people aspiring to, was in part at least because the homosexual community, which had a very full agenda, largely accomplished, if not completely accomplished, needed something to justify its continued machinery and infrastructure and appetite for contributions. And this became the thing. Is there any evidence that supports that theory?
Well, I keep learning new things about that. But it is true that after the Obergefell decision came down, legalizing, you know, same-sex marriage nationwide, there was this kind of, well, what do we do now? But really, the trans ideologues had sort of always been there jockeying for power and influence. And while I am very much a small O Orthodox Christian and believe very deeply in historic Christian sexual ethics, I, in the last several years, I've met several gay men and lesbians who are absolutely outraged and opposed to this madness and have been resisting it. But in fact, I heard one say just the other day that she wishes they would have just closed up shop when Obergefell came down, but no. And it's true that all of the major gay rights organizations, with the exception of the very recently formed LGB Alliance, and that's a British organization, and there's an American chapter now too, are all now fervently pushing transgender ideology. And it's true that I think, what do they do now with all of this infrastructure, all of this money? And a lot of this money, as I was saying a moment ago, does come from the medical industrial complex. There are a lot of those funders. I mean, the Arcus Foundation.
Self-dealing.
The Arcus Foundation is a big, you know, funder of all this stuff. And that's Stryker Medical Corporation, where the billions of dollars from that come. And the guy, I think his name is John Stryker, he's a homosexual man. And there are very wealthy homosexual funders and people who are just pushing this ideology all across the board. And those who are trying to raise the alarm from within their ranks are not being listened to or heard. So it's quite something.
Well, it's why your work is so important, Brendan. And I hope that our audience will take the opportunity, as I intend to check out generational what was it called? I'm sorry.
Generation Indoctrination. If I may also very quickly, check out deadnamedocumentary.com, because I think, Frank, we're going to be seeing not only detransitioners who have been brutalized medically, and that's not hyperbole, their bodies have been permanently altered and they've been sterilized. The fractured families that this is causing is off the charts. So if you go to deadnamedocumentary.com, you'll see three families profiled. I make a brief appearance in that film. That'll give you a taste of the anguish, because as the detransitioners are testifying in state legislatures and talking about the harm to their person, the family rupture is going to be, I think, where really people get it. And so that documentary will really underline that point.
I appreciate you providing all of these resources to us, Brandon. Thank you. Keep up the great work, and come back, if you would, with updates on all of it. It's vital. I'm going to take just a minute to leave you with a further thought, folks, if I may, about a story that we've been covering as well. It involves this idea that the state of Israel is engaged in genocide. And I just wanted to put before you a couple of facts. The levels of death and destruction that has taken place as a direct result of the invasion of Israel is, you know, regrettable. But to the extent that it's even what the Palestinian so-called Gaza Health Ministry, whatever that is, has generated, it is a tiny fraction of the people that are in that densely packed community in Gaza. It is also a considerably smaller number of people that were killed in any number of attacks by the United States and its allies in World War II, for example, to say nothing of, you know, the dropping of the atomic bomb. We need perspective on all of this. It's not to excuse attacks on civilians. It's to say that I don't believe for a moment that that's what Israel is determined to engage in, let alone genocide. And if they were, it would have been vastly more devastating than this, you can be sure. We'll be following this story closely. I hope you'll be paying attention to some of those facts as you hear evidence asserted in the International Court of Justice, for example, by South Africa. It ain't so, folks. We'll be talking more with all of you, I hope, at the next edition of Securing America. Until then, go forth and multiply.